Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 3 minutes after 9 a.m., September 25th, 2012. We're joined today by the co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, Senator McGuire. We have two bills on the agenda this morning. We're going to start with Senate Bill 39, U.S. Presidential Election Compact, and we're going to go to House Bill 121, Loan Funds, Charter, Mariculture, Microloans. So first up, Senate Bill 39 by Senator French regarding the U.S. Presidential Compact. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further review. And Senator French is detained in a crime summit in another meeting room in the building. So we have representation from his office, and if she could come forward, please. If she could introduce herself, who she represents, and then walk us through the bill and tell us what this does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lisa Weisler. I'm staff to Senator French, and he does send his regrets and his appreciation for your hearing the bill. Senator French likes to say the bedrock rule in elections is that the person with the most votes wins, but that doesn't always happen under our current election system. It starts with the U.S. Constitution, that directs each state to appoint a number of electors equal to the state's number of senators and representatives. In Alaska, that's three electors. The Constitution also leaves to the states how the electors are appointed. In Alaska, the state party convention for each political party selects the state's electors, then each elector pledges their votes for the candidate of the party. The presidential candidate that wins the most votes in the state wins the state's three electors' votes. And that's how it works in 48 of the 50 states. The candidate with at least 270 electoral votes wins the presidency. Now, this creates a problem for a state like Alaska, where there's no question which candidate's going to get the most votes. So one candidate can bank our three electoral votes while the other gives up on the state. The Alaska's contribution to the national election is over before a single vote is cast. Now, because of this, candidates focus their campaigns on states where the outcome of the vote is uncertain, the so-called battleground states. Alaskans watch from the sidelines while candidates debate issues that don't necessarily impact our lives here. Now, another problem with the current system is that it doesn't always mean that the person with the most votes wins. The candidate can get fewer individual votes than their opponent, but still get enough electoral votes. And this has happened four times in the country's 56 elections. It almost happened in 2004, where a shift of just 60,000 votes in Ohio would have given John Kerry the electoral votes to win, despite President Bush leading in the national popular vote, the vote of all 50 states, by 3 million votes. So under Senate Bill 39, what this will change is that instead of our electoral votes going to the candidate with the most state votes, the most votes from Alaska, we'll pool our votes with the votes of all 50 states, and then whichever candidate has the most votes nationally will get our three electoral votes. Now, this will put Alaska back in play. So a vote in Nome will have the same weight, the same value as a vote in Cleveland, Ohio. Candidates will have to address our issues to get our votes. And not just the candidates, but also the incumbent who wants a second term. They won't be able to backburner Alaska's issues and concerns their first term. We will be courted. By pulling our votes with every state's individual votes, the person with the most votes wins. Now, under the bill, under SB 39, it'll add a new section to the state election statutes in AS 1530. Alaska will enter the agreement to elect the president by national popular vote and the vote of all 50 states with the other states that join the compact. In the bill, there's five articles. These make up the agreement. Under Article 1, any state and the District of Columbia may join the compact by enacting the same agreement. Under Article 2, that requires that member states conduct a statewide popular election for the president and vice president, so we have our votes to throw into the national poll. Article 3 will provide the process for how the presidential electors are appointed under the compact. Then Article 4, a couple of provisions I'd like to point out there. One is that the compact won't take effect until it's enacted by enough states to give a majority of the electoral votes needed to elect the president. That's 270 out of 530 electoral votes. And so far, 9 states have enacted the bill for a total of 132 electoral votes, so we're almost halfway there. Also, a state may withdraw from the compact. Article 5 provides the definitions. Section 153098 just explains that the director of the Division of Elections is the chief election officer described by the compact, and the remaining sections amend the state election laws as necessary to accommodate the changes once the compact is activated. So in sum, SB 39 guarantees that the person with the most votes is the winner of the presidential election, and it ensures that every Alaskan's vote counts. Thank you.
And do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Because we do have some folks to represent this issue also coming after her. Senator Hoffman.
Yes, many people say that going to the popular vote, we will be getting rid of or do away with the Electoral College. And I wonder if you might respond to that.
Well, I can say that no, that's not the case, and I would leave it to one of the experts to explain more on that question.
And then do you know how many people in Alaska support changing the system?
I do not have that data. I apologize. Oh, sorry, through the chair. I apologize to the chair. I do not have that information, but I suspect one of our experts will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any other initial questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Weisler, a couple of years ago there was SB 92 that was, how similar or dissimilar is this bill to that Senate bill?
For the chair, I believe it's very similar.
Very similar?
Mm-hmm. The compact needs to be the same across all the states.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other initial questions? Okay. With that, we'll start our public hearing portion, and what I'm going to do is ask Ms. Laura Broad. Rod, come forward, please. Maybe the bill sponsor could hang out. There might be some interaction between the two, but if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then I think you are involved in this issue, so you can help us with a little more detail on the subject matter, please.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm Laura Broad, L-A-U-R-A-B-R-O-D, from Minnesota, and I'm a former state representative from Minnesota, and I do understand, Mr. Chairman, that you are the upper body, so just wanted to make that clear. I was involved in this legislation while I was a state representative. I was there for 8 years, and we have made significant progress in our state, and there's progress being made across the country on this very important issue, and so I really appreciate the fact that you are taking it up today. Let me just quickly say that what this bill will do is that it will guarantee the presidency to the candidate who wins the most votes in all 50 states. And it does so through utilizing a state's right that is explicitly stated in the Constitution through Article 2, Section 1, where the founders wrote 17 words, and they wrote, "Each state shall appoint in a manner as the legislature thereof shall direct a slate of electors." This bill is truly a bill that is before the legislatures because that's where the power lies. The power doesn't lie in the Constitution for awarding electors. That is an explicit and plenary state power, and the courts have actually supported that state's power throughout the years. There's significant momentum across the country on this bill. It's a nonpartisan bill, which is actually one of the most exciting things, is that there is a broad coalition of people who support this legislation throughout the country and here in Alaska. When you look at the 7 out of 10 Alaskans are very interested in making sure their vote counts and their vote is leveraged and is equal to votes in other places of the country. 9 states, as Lisa mentioned, 9 states have passed the legislation equaling 132 electoral votes, which is about 49% of the way to the trigger point, and the trigger point is enough states need to join. Should Alaska pass this legislation, they would join the other 9 states. And enough states need to join the compact to equal 270 electoral votes. And that's the point at which the compact triggers into effect. So effectively, you join the compact with enough other states to get to 270, which is the number it takes to elect the president. The legislation has passed 31 chambers in 21 states. It's a pretty broad coalition of folks who are moving this bill throughout the country. In addition to that, over 2,000 legislators in the country have either been a co-sponsor or have voted for this bill. So there's a lot of movement and a lot of support. So the big question is, so why is this good for Alaska? It's kind of a, you know, the founders gave state legislators the opportunity to make this decision and expected that you make it in the best interest of your state and of your citizens. So why would this be good for Alaska? Well, the current winner-take-all system, and again, here's how it currently works. And I know you guys know this, but I think it's just good to kind of get back to the basics of here's how it currently works. Under the current system, whoever wins Alaska gets all of the three electoral votes, and that's called the winner-take-all. Interestingly, the winner-take-all rule is a state statute. It's not in the Constitution. It's a state statute, and that's why it's appropriate if you want to change that state statute that you do it through a state law. But under the current system, the winner-take-all rule, what we've seen is that the campaigns are so focused on states where they're competitive that they effectively ignore states that are reliably red states and reliably blue states. They effectively count on their votes or know they're never going to get those votes. And so the winner-take-all system has created a structure where 15 states in this country are relevant to the campaigns. 15 states in this country, which makes 35 states in this country irrelevant or flyover. I won't say totally irrelevant, but it makes them a flyover for the campaigns. They don't seek the votes of the people. They don't spend money there. They don't pull the issues that are important to those 35 states because they are so focused on turning the vote in those few states. So if you want to make sure that Alaskans' interests are taken into account in campaigns and that the Alaskans' voices are expanded the way that they should have been expanded in the original intent, the best way to do that is to make the candidates find you relevant and make the candidates want to seek the votes of the folks here in Alaska. Interestingly, there's no money that really comes into the state, but Alaskans spend contribute about $1.6 million to various campaigns, and that money is taken out of the state and is spent to buy ads in places like Pennsylvania, in Ohio. There's no visits to Alaska in the general election by the candidates. They already know they got the votes here, or they know they're not going to get the votes here. And most importantly to me, as a legislator, the issues of Alaskans are not being taken into account when the presidential campaigns are campaigning or while they're governing. When you look at the issues, let's say ANWR or land management, you know, they might talk about them in the primary, but they are nowhere on the agenda during the general campaign. And those issues are important to the people who are talking to me in your state. And I know in Minnesota, the issues that our people care about should be on the agenda and should be on the tips of the tongues of the candidates as well, but they're not. Another reason why this would be good for Alaskans is that actually when I fly out from Seattle to Juneau, it never fails that somebody on the plane, when we start chatting about the issue, that they say, well, yeah, well, we already know who the president is by the time I get off of work. So why should I go vote? And so one of the things that a national popular vote would do, if you look at where the battleground states are, they're on the east. In a national popular vote, they would have to wait for the west. They would at least have to wait till Alaskans have gotten to the polls to call the presidential election. And I think that would be good also for the people of Alaska. And also lastly, it just simply every vote would count in a way that it currently doesn't count today. Every vote would be leveraged in a way that it's currently not leveraged today, and every person would feel that their vote is counted or cast and counted for the candidate that they think best represents their interests. So I've told you a little bit about what the bill does, but let me just hit a couple of concerns that we've heard, because I think the concerns are valid and real, and I want to make sure that we address those here today. First concern that I often hear is this bill, as Senator Hoffman mentioned, will abolish the Electoral College. I can tell you unequivocally, it does not. This bill doesn't abolish the Electoral College. In fact, it does not even touch the Electoral College, which was set up in the Constitution. It is also not what some would have concerns, that this is an end run around the Constitution. Well, you can't end run around an article that is specifically designed through the Constitution, which gives states the authority to make this decision, and that's Article 2, Section 1. So rather than being an end run around, I would argue that this is actually an explicit use of a state's power and a state's right that was designed by the founders. Another concern that we often hear is, well, we're a small state, and we were given an advantage in the Electoral College. That's a concern, and to tell you the truth, I had that concern too when I first came to look at this issue. But when you look at the number of electoral votes doesn't change. So that stays the same under the current system or under national popular vote. That stays the same. But the current winner-take-all rules, the state statutes, are disadvantaging the small states in this country because they are negating their voice. And the reason is that 12 out of the 13 smallest states, of which Alaska is one, 12 out of the 13 smallest states are flyover states. They're either reliably red or reliably blue, which means that the candidates don't seek their votes. No visits, no attention, no money, no polling. Now that's not an advantage to those small states. The other thing I often hear is, well, we're so small, no one will come here anyway. And I will tell you that we may not see Air Force One fly into Alaska, but they certainly will be caring about the issues that are important to Alaskans. They'll have people on the ground because they will need to seek every single one of those votes throughout the country in a broad coalition. You have, in 2008, you had roughly 321,000 votes. Show me a candidate who ignores those votes, and I'll show you a candidate who can't win. Those are important votes, and they would seek those votes in a way they're not seeking them today. And then the last issue that I just want to put on the table that you might have some concerns about, because I, again, did too, is that the big cities in this country will kind of rule the day. Big cities in this country will determine who becomes our president, and that just ignores electoral demography. When you look at where people live in this country, if you take the 50 largest cities, 50th largest city, by the way, is in Texas. It is, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, Arlington, Texas, not huge, 250,000, 275, excuse me. The 50 largest cities in this country only equal 18% of our nation's population. So if you think about it, 82% of the people live outside of that space. So the 50 largest cities, even if they voted 100% one way or the other, they wouldn't be able to determine the presidency. Candidates would seek the votes from all of us. And all you have to do is to look at governor's races to see how campaigns would work. In a state like mine in Minnesota, Governor Pawlenty, a Republican, ran two terms, never won one of the largest cities. But he won the state because he drove the vote up in the places outside of the cities, and he worked hard enough to get enough votes on the inside of the cities. And so you run campaigns different, and that's why this issue would bring Alaskans into the conversation, is because they would need the votes, they would seek the votes, and they would want to talk about the things that are important to your state. So, Mr. Chairman and members, I appreciate the opportunity. This bill really, truly is for people who want to solve a shortcoming of our winner-take-all rules and statutes, while at the same time protecting the structure of the Electoral College that the founders set up. And by doing so, you can make sure that the voices of Alaskans, the votes of Alaskans, are as equal as the votes in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and that every vote counts in every state in every election. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any initial questions? Senator Hoffman.
The other question that I had asked the sponsor dealt with what are the citizens of Alaska views on changing the system? I wonder if you could address that, and I have a couple of more questions.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hoffman, we've done some polling in Alaska, and what we've found is that it's almost 70%. So 7 out of 10 Alaskans believe that a national popular vote is in the best interests of them and their state.
And why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think it comes down to a couple things. Just from the people that I've talked to, and I've talked to a number of folks and talked to a number of you about the issues that your constituents are talking to you about, I think it's a couple things. I think they don't want the presidency called before they get to the polls. I think they truly believe that their voices are not being heard in the presidential campaigns. And I think that a lot of that is because the candidates are not talking about the issues that they care most about. And that is the piece that concerns me most. If candidates are not talking about what's important to a broad swath of this country, then they're not actually going to be governing on what's important too. And so when you think about a lot of folks have talked to me about Anwar, and they say, well, gosh, if the candidates actually needed our vote and wanted our votes, they might actually talk about that issue in the general election and not just kind of talk about it, but maybe actually get some things done. And land management is another issue that I've heard a lot about.
Senator Hoffman?
The other question, I guess, is that the sponsor had mentioned the 2004 election where Kerry would have gotten the popular vote. What's the history? Does that benefit one party or the other on the popular vote?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hoffman, that's a great question. You know, I actually believe that that's why you're seeing a nonpartisan coalition forming in favor of this bill, because it cuts both ways. You know, you have four times in history where we've had the person who has gotten the most popular votes not win the presidency, and one of those times obviously was in 2000. And it's important, and I think a lot of Republicans realize that in 2004, it could have gone exactly the opposite direction. 50,000 some votes change hands in one precinct or one county or one part of Ohio, and you have an exact opposite situation, actually even with a greater differentiation between popular votes and the Electoral College. So it really cuts both ways.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGuire and then Senator Thomas.
Thank you, and through the chair, thank you, Laura, for your work both as a member of the House of Representatives in Minnesota and now educating us on this issue. Regardless of how people vote, you've brought an interesting perspective. Can you walk this committee through briefly how it would be enforced? Let's say that your movement, MPV, secures the requisite 270 electoral votes needed to secure its passage. How then will it be executed and enforced? And then finally, a little bit more on the constitutionality of it. I hear your perspective, but do you expect there to be a constitutional challenge made to the U.S. Supreme Court, and how do you think that will fare?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator McGuire. We are a litigious society, and so, yeah, I expect somebody will probably sue about something, just like they do about every other issue. But in regards to the constitutionality of it, there's a number of cases and case law that actually back up the constitutionality of this piece of legislation. The first of which is McPherson v. Blacker, which is an 1893 case. And in this case, effectively, the Supreme Court stated that the awarding of electors is a plenary state power. So it's an explicit state's right. And so that case law effectively supports the 17 words that are stated in the Constitution in Article 2, Section 1. In regards to the compacts piece, compacts and interstate compacts are tools that are used by legislatures and legislators in all states. In fact, I think you guys just recently passed one related to education of military children, which I supported and offered in Minnesota. So state compacts are a tool that is used by state legislatures and are a typical tool. And only twice in state history has there been pre-approval for a compact, and so it's a non-typical way to go about a state compact. Generally, states pass the compact, and at the point at which the compact is triggered, then whether it needs congressional approval or not, that decision is made at that time. And so state compacts, as you know, are set up as another state tool in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, which gives states the authority to enter into compacts or contracts with other states. And all the legislation does is actually is take that compact mechanism and use it for an explicit state's power, which is your authority to award electoral votes how you see fit. So the mechanism is if you pass the legislation, which, by the way, has to be passed in the same substantial form as all other states, it's 888 words, you pass the legislation, you enter into the compact, and by the way, nothing changes until enough other states have joined you to equal the 270. At that point, the compact triggers into effect. So that's the mechanism. That's the mechanism that is used. And again, Article 1, Section 10 gives that authority in interstate compacts in the Constitution. And interestingly, it was an authority that was granted in the Articles of Confederation as well. So it's a longstanding authority that states have. In addition to that, in terms of the enforceability side of it, every state, the fallacy that some folks have about how this works, and this is an important point, is that they think, okay, so if we go to a national popular vote, we're going to have the people of Alaska vote, and we're going to put all those votes in a little bag, and we're going to send them somewhere to be counted. You know, that's kind of a visual that people have. But really, what we do in our compact, and is appropriate based on the Constitution and our Federalist principles, is that the states retain the authority for elections. You retain your authority for elections, and that's appropriate. Because so in that case, you will have a total. The state of Alaska will certify that total, just like you do today. And there's absolutely no changes. In terms of enforceability, the total votes are total votes as designed and determined by Alaska, by your Secretary of State, your Lieutenant Governor. So that number is determined by you, and then the numbers are all totaled together. So there's no losing of your identity, there's no losing of your vote, control over your votes. Alaska will retain her control over those votes and over those numbers and over that identity. There's long experience related to enforceability of compacts, again, in the Constitution, you can't impair a contract. And it's a contract. Compacts are contracts, and so the enforceability is very clear, and has been very tested.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your explanation. Just to help me understand, are we talking about each state or states that signed the compact passing along a percentage, a breakout, and passing along then their electoral vote? Like, let's just make it simple, one-third, two-thirds. So in our case, three electoral votes, one would go one and two the other way. Are we talking about simply taking the and certifying the popular vote for the Republican or the Democrat running for the presidency and passing that along to the other group that puts the Electoral College that would then put that together? So I guess I'm saying, are we using the percentages and dividing up by state the electoral vote, or are we passing along the numbers and allowing that to be done somewhere else?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, that's a great question. And what we're doing, or what this compact will do and what Alaska will do should you choose to join it, is that you will look at, you'll take all of the votes of the Alaskans, so say the 320,000 Alaskan votes, and you will determine who won Alaska. But you will determine who won Alaska for, or determine the votes for Alaska for both candidates, okay? And then the totals for each candidate will be based on the totals from all 50 states. All 50 states. And then based on that total, if you're a member of the compact, which people join it equaling 270, more can join, but you can't go less. So at that point in which you total your votes, then Alaska's electoral votes, or the electors who are sent to the Capitol a month later, it's a month later, will base their or the slate of electors will be based on who won the national popular vote. So it's not a proportional system where you're giving a third here or two-thirds there. And the reason that doesn't work is because electors are people and not pieces of paper. And so it's easy to say, well, we could do 24.5 here and 74, you know, over there, or 75.6 over there. But that's not what, how it works, because you're actually voting for electors. No, it's effectively a all of the votes in the country will be added up for each candidate. The slate of electors will be determined based on that candidate.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the guest today? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Laura, thank you very much for coming all this way to go ahead and get some enlightenment. I find it interesting that you come from a state as a Democrat. I can say this, that you elect Al Franken and Jesse Ventura to some pretty prestigious positions.
Mr. Chairman, we are a creative sort.
I'm sure that you are. Actually, one of the things that I was looking at was, as you look at some of the, how do you deal with voter fraud and where you have an incomplete number of votes that are counted, we just had an election up on the North Slope where I have been living and working, and they had some boxes that were missing or out of a chain of command or chain of custody. How do you deal with that? And as we get more and more into the computer age, where computers are becoming more of a dominant part of elections, and you're dealing with some of the problems with computers, especially in rural Alaska, where electricity is not all that reliable, and computers, you know, just don't work as well. How does this make my constituents more comfortable that their vote does indeed count? Because obviously your presentation is pretty is compelling, but there are issues out there.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I think that one thing that I represented a rural area also, and the rural voters really want to make sure. You know, they're a very conscientious group of people. You know, they want to make sure they're doing their civic duty, but they also want to make sure that it counts. And that's why just even having candidates coming to your state will make that voice even more important than it is today. That's one thing. Two things. In regards to the laws related to internet voting and things like that, every state can make those decisions. You here in Alaska can make the decisions based on what you think is in the best interests of Alaska. And that's actually the brilliance of the Federalist system, where states maintain control. So the way it works today is that states have control over their election system, and the way it works under a national popular vote is states maintain that control, and the state legislatures then can make the decisions concerning how do you engage the population. In regards to voter fraud, it's very interesting that under our current system, let me back up. Related to voter fraud, I mean, I believe if you look at the way things work today, is that voter fraud actually will be lessened and will be much less targeted under a national popular vote. And here's why. In the current system right now, where you have such few states with such focus, you know, again, 98% of all campaign spending occurs in 15 states. 75% of that spending occurs in 5 states. So the focus is on those 5 states, right? So if you're going to be cheating, if you're one of those folks who says, I'm going to cheat some votes, you know exactly where to go to cheat. You know exactly what precincts to go. You know exactly where you need to go, not just to get a few votes, but to potentially turn an entire state. For example, so say you have votes in, I think there was a case in Milwaukee. You know, you know exactly where to go, and you aren't just negating one legal vote with one illegal vote. You have the potential of negating millions of legal votes, because under the current system, it is so targeted where you have to go to turn those votes over. Under a national popular vote, with 300 and some million votes, the pool is much larger, And nobody will know us in such a targeted way like they do today under the winner-take-all system, but they won't know exactly where to go to cheat in such a massive scale. Under a national popular vote, voter fraud would have to be executed on such a massive scale that there is no way it would be under the radar like it is potentially today. And so, again, I believe that a national popular vote, just statistically, will diffuse the effectiveness of fraud and will actually be in the best interest of ensuring that fraud does not sway elections and sway a huge amount of electors, if that's something you're concerned about, and a lot of folks are.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laura, there have been times when members of the Electoral College from states don't necessarily vote for the candidate that the Electoral College thought they were going to cast their ballot for. Would this eliminate that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Egan, those are the, there's been 11 cases in history where there's been a voter who has not done what was expected in regards to their electoral vote. Only one of them, interestingly, though, only one of them actually thought that changing their vote would actually change the outcome of an election, and that was Samuel Miles. But when you think about what they call faithless electors, that still remains within the state law. So many states are passing what's called the Uniform Election Law legislation, which is intended to bind their electors. But we don't address that because that is a state law. It's a state issue. And so states are addressing the issue of faithless electors as they see fit, and our legislation won't change that. And the other thing that's important to know is that you're not going to be sending a slate of electors to vote for the other guy. And keep in mind who these slate of electors are. They're party faithful. The Republicans party nominates a slate. The Democratic Party nominates a slate. And the slate that will be sent to the Capitol to make the votes a month after the election are the slate that align with the candidate who wins the most popular vote. So you're never going to ask a Republican to cast a vote for a Democrat and vice versa. And that's why the idea of faithless electors is not expanded or made worse under our bill. It's the same as under the current system.
Okay.
Thank you.
One more follow-up, and then we're going to move on to the off-net.
Great. Thank you. You were talking about percentage of population. I'm just curious. Anchorage, the largest city in our state, is number 126 in the media market. 126. So I'm just curious, how much of the U.S. population lives in the top 50? Do you have a clue? Media markets?
In the top 50 media markets, I don't off the top of my head, but I bet I could come up with that information. But actually, your point is really important because it actually shows why people will come to Alaska, is that even the largest media market in your state is number 126 in the nation. From a cost per vote standpoint, I'd be stupid to ignore Alaska as a candidate. In fact, it just wouldn't happen because from a cost per vote, getting out the vote and driving people to go out and vote and actually running up your tally, depending on which side you're on, it would be a very inexpensive and important part of winning an election under a national popular vote system, whereas right now your media market is effectively irrelevant to those candidates because they're not marketing here.
Okay. So we're going to take one more question from Senator Hoffman, and we're going to go to the off-net.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You listed many reasons why it's good to go to the national popular vote. Campaign dollars being spent in the state. Two, the presidential candidate won't be declared until the West was closed, and most important to Alaska, probably issues such as ANWR would be potentially more likely to be addressed by a presidential candidate. What do you think are some of the drawbacks to Alaska by changing the system?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hoffman, I honestly have thought a lot about that because I thought a lot about it for my own state, and I really can't come up with many. When you think when you think about the positives that come out of engaging every single person in this country in a way that they're not engaged today, I don't think that there's a negative out there in doing that. The other thing is that I'm here today to tell you that I believe that national popular vote is in the best interests of our country, and from those I talk to, in the best interests of Alaska and in my state, Minnesota, and many others in this country. But I'm not here to tell you that it's the best system ever imagined. And that's why the founders left it up to the states to make that decision. And that's why our bill has the ability and retains the state power to enter into the compact, but also to leave the compact. Should you decide at a future time that this is not in the best interest of Alaska, you know what you do? You pull out. And as soon as the compact drops below 270, you go back to your current law. So even if there was a drawback that I'm not seeing today, or that you might not be seeing today, this doesn't bind you forever, and that's actually a unique thing to this compact, because there's many other compacts out there that are tighter and that bind states a little bit stronger. But this compact really, really utilizes the state's power and recognizes that state's power and allows states to enter the compact and to leave the compact 3.5 out of 4 years of every election. The only time, based on the compact language, that you're not allowed to leave the compact is between July 20th and January 20th, and that's just so there's no manipulation intent or a potential manipulation for people entering and leaving and things like that during the campaign. But this really retains that state's power, Senator. But to answer your question very directly, I can't think of any. I mean, I truly believe that that this is not only a good idea, but this idea will engage people in this country in a way that will make them pay attention that they're not doing today.
Okay. With that, we're going to move to the off-net, and thank you for your testimony. We're going to go to Judy Andry. If you could please identify yourself, who you represent, and speak to the bill, and hold your comments to 2 minutes, please.
Yes, this is Judy Andry, and I'm calling in from Juneau, Alaska, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the National Popular Vote Compact, or Senate Bill 39. I've been studying this issue for a year now as a member of the League of Women Voters. I have read the book, yes, the book, and followed the NPV website, and learned, much to my amazement, that the NPV Compact is truly a bipartisan effort. However, I'm very aware of the change such a compact would bring to our national elections. To many, the Electoral College is enshrined in our nation's history and not something to be tampered with. But, you know, the reality of our history indicates that the political landscape surrounding the birth of the Electoral College has dramatically changed over time. And Laura spoke eloquently to one of those changes. Another change it involves the rise of political parties and the national tendency to put party ahead of country. From this development came the winner-take-all use of the electoral votes held by each state. The majority of the states cast their electoral votes for the winner of the popular vote at the state level. Now, to me, this seems like a tragic irony, as it leaves those voters who vote for the losing candidate at the state level completely left out of the vote count at the national level, where the election is really happening. The current system leaves progressive voters in a red state and conservative voters in a blue state pretty well assured that their votes for president and vice president will never find their way to the final vote count, that the count that matters, the electoral votes. I am one of those citizens, one of those 7 out of 10 in Alaska who believe every individual vote should be counted at the national level, and the winner of that count should be the winner of the election. The National Popular Vote Compact ensures that the winner of the popular vote at the national level is indeed the winner of the election. Each state has the right to determine how its electoral votes are cast, and as Laura explained, this is in the Constitution. So supporting and passing Senate Bill 39 will give every Alaskan citizen the confidence to know that when the compact goes into effect, every vote will indeed count, just as it does as a state and local elections. If you think about it, we're using the popular vote to elect our governor. Why should the voting population expect any less at the national level, that every vote would count and the winner would be the one with the most votes? I urge you to thoughtfully consider the importance of each vote counting and to decide to support Senate Bill 39. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy, for your testimony today. Next up, Carolyn Brown, please.
Yes, I'm Carolyn Brown. I came to Alaska in 1965, and I currently live in Juneau, although I'm calling in from Anchorage today. I strongly support Senate Bill 39 for the following reasons. It's very clear that Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution states that each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. It is very noteworthy that no mention is made of an electoral college. As you know, our processes of electing the president have developed and changed over the history of our country. This includes even election by the Congress. These processes, also chosen by each state, have included selection by state legislators, by district electoral votes, by state governors, and by the current winner-take-all electoral vote of a particular party. Now, a majority of Americans want their individual votes to be cast nationwide for the president of all of the United States. It has been said 70% of Alaskans want their individual votes to be cast nationwide for the president of the entire United States. We are not about electing the president of a particular state. We are about electing the president of the United States. The individual vote, individual count process assures that more is to be considered than the designated prized 7 to 14 battleground states will collect the electoral votes for president. Candidates will understand the mandate to provide attention to the voices and opinions of all citizens in the remaining 36 to 43 states and the District of Columbia. This concept of every vote counts is as critical for election of the president as it is for election of our governors, our senators, our representatives, and our elected officials of our communities. I strongly encourage you to vote for Senate Bill 39 and to assure passage of this legislation for all Alaskans and Americans. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Brown, for your testimony today. Next up, we're going to jump up to Fairbanks. Randy Griffin, please.
Hello, my name, can you hear me? Hello?
Barely. Yes, we could barely hear you. If you could speak up a little bit, please. Mr. Griffin?
Hello, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we could hear you. If you can identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, I'm very sorry about that. Didn't know the procedure here. My name is Randy Griffin, Post Office Box 73653, Fairbanks, Alaska 99707. There it is. And I'm just speaking for myself. I'm very much opposed to this bill. We have in our congressional delegation more representation than we quote unquote deserve, because the framers made it that way. And of course our electors are the same as our representatives. Therefore, we have much more clout per person in the state of Alaska for representing, for voting for a president than other states like California, for instance. An enormous amount more power per person here in Alaska. And this bill would destroy, it would take away that advantage that we have. It would diminish us down to this, to the status of the citizens of California. But so that's one reason why we should absolutely not pass this bill. Secondly, I understand, of course, the liberals want to pass it because we usually vote conservative, and they don't like that. So I can understand that. But the main reason why I'm against this is because I like the electoral system, because in the public's mind, it accentuates the state boundaries. Because everyone is always on edge at election night, you know, which way is Illinois going to go, which way is, Nevada going to go, and all that. and therefore it highlights the boundaries. It makes the states seem like little nations practically, because when nations vote in the United Nations, for instance, they don't split their vote, they vote as a consensus block, you know. And so I like that same thing, because and that helps with states' rights, because gradually the public consciousness is or liberals would like the public to forget about states' rights and states' boundaries, so that the federal government has all the power. And of course the federal government has been increasing its take on power for many, many decades, and it's just continuing that way. Obamacare is a perfect example. But had this law passed, you know, in 2008, or had it been in effect in 2008, you know, all of our votes here in Alaska, instead of recognizing the will of the Alaskan people, all of our electors would have gone to Barack Hussein Obama, and that would be a terrible thing. And so I say no on this SB 39. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Griffin, for your testimony today. With that, that concludes our off-net. We're going to now come back into the room. Margo Waring, is that correct? She can come forward, please.
My name is Margo Waring, and I live in Juneau. Thank you for this opportunity. I first learned about the national popular vote concept as a member of the Juneau League of Women Voters, and spent some time really trying to understand it, although clearly I'm not an expert the way Ms. Broad is. The history of voting in this country has been one of expanding the franchise and assuring that one man, one vote is the approach that more and more we've used. But we've also seen in practice that not every vote always counts. In practice, we've seen that we can have cases in which the majority of the vote is not the same as the president who is elected. Most people in this country ask that flat-out question of, is that fair? Will say, no, it's not fair. Every vote should count, and votes shouldn't be discounted. They also shouldn't be discounted, as we've heard, because voters don't live in swing states. I really think that the problems of fairness, of making sure that all voices are heard, and that voices are heard in small states like ours, because our votes would count more, is a really strong reason to support SB 39. The our belief in democracy, our attention to Alaskan voices, and our desire to have those voices heard on the national stage, together are the strongest reasons that I have for supporting SB 39, and I hope you'll agree. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony today. Ruth Danner?
Thank you, Senator Stedman, Senators. My name is Ruth Danner. I have the honor of serving as an assembly member of the City and Borough of Juneau, but I'm here today only as myself to speak to the national popular vote. I'm so excited. I can't tell you how excited I am to be here to talk to you about this. This is an issue that's bugged me since fifth grade. I can't imagine why it is that my vote should count less than a vote in Florida or South Carolina. I want my vote to count, and it seems that the votes of the three votes for Alaska are taken for granted, so that before the polls are closed, the decision is made. The candidates don't determine the issues based on what's important to Alaskans. And so 40% of registered voters in Alaska opt out. They decide to stay home because they know their decision, their vote won't change the outcome, and they haven't been able to hear what the candidates truly think about the things that are important to them, and it's cold outside. So they stay home. And that impacts us on local races and local issues. I want the candidates to talk about things like federal land management. I want them to talk about Native issues. I want them to tell me what their solutions are to our problems with drug and alcohol addiction and how we're going to deal with the suicide epidemic in our state. Alaskans raise $1.6 million that go toward the presidential campaign. And that all goes to ads that are making the poor people in Iowa and South Carolina just sick. If we spread that money out, you know, what if we spent some of that $1.6 million at our radio and television stations here in Alaska? What if we spent it on events here? How would it change the face of the election if people like me could rub elbows with people like you as we talk about the issues and the candidates? I mean, wouldn't that like be like democracy? Wouldn't that be exciting? I hope that you will consider this issue seriously. I only really became aware and that it was anything but a pipe dream 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, I started looking at the website. I started asking the questions because I did have questions about, you know, the influence of big states and, you know, wouldn't this be bad? We still get our three electoral votes under this circumstance. So I think that we still will have the influence, in fact, more influence, because they'll have to care about things like federal land management. I hope that you will sign SB 39 in support of the national popular vote. Today we'll make, if we do this, we will make history. We'll demonstrate our commitment to fairness, our commitment to the every vote counts in the most important election of what is arguably the most powerful position in the world. Let's send a message to the lower 48. Let's tell them that Alaskans care enough to make the best candidate win. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Last up, Barry Fadden. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and try not to repeat the previous testimony because I'm watching the clock here and we got to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will keep my remarks brief. My name is Barry Fadden. I'm the president of National Popular Vote, which is a 501c4 nonprofit organization set up to support the proposal. I'm just quickly going to mention two things. When Randy, who just testified, made three statements, he said Alaska has much more clout under the current system, Alaska has advantages under the current system, and that the proposed national popular vote proposal would go against state rights. So I would just quickly like to state that under the current system, Alaska has no clout. Alaska is in very good company. There are 35 other states that are not battleground states. Alaska is one of those. But under the current system, the statement that Alaska has more clout is just not a true statement. Whatever advantages Randy thinks the state enjoys from the current system, I'm not sure what those would be. And his statement that it goes against state rights, as Representative Broad has testified, the only reason we're here talking about this proposal is that the Founding Fathers, in their eminent wisdom, decided that the states should have the right to determine how electoral votes are awarded. So from our perspective, this is one of the ultimate state issues and state powers granted to the states by the Founding Fathers.
Mr. Fed, we'll just leave Randy out of it and have you just address the points that other people made, if you'd like to.
The last thing I'd like to state is that under national popular vote, Alaska and every other state would be involved in the presidential election. Some people have commented that perhaps candidates would not visit Alaska, but I just wanted to point out there are numerous indications of a presidential campaign. Candidate might visit the state, TV and radio ads that we've talked about, but another important component of presidential elections are grassroots, where people at the local level worked actively in support of their candidate. We believe on a national popular vote, grassroots activities in all 50 states will occur. So in summary, we think that the result of the national popular vote proposal is that it will make every vote in every state matter in every presidential election. Thank you very much.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Fathom?
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Seeing none, that concludes the public testimony portion. We'll come back to the committee. Do we have any final questions of the bill sponsor? Seeing none, any final comments by the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside?
Thank you again.
Okay, thank you. We have, before we set this aside, we do have 10 fiscal note from the Division of Elections on that subject matter. Okay, we're going to go on now to the second bill up of the day, and that is House Bill 121 by the Governor regarding loan funds for charter, mariculture, and microloans. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the bill sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside. With us today is Commissioner Susan Bell and one of her trustee aides. And if Ms. Bell could introduce herself for the record, who she represents, and speak to the bill, please.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to House Bill 121. I'm Susan Bell, Commissioner for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And with me today is Kathy Jeans. She's the Operations Manager for the Division of Economic Development's Financing Section and a 15-year veteran of the division. We've prepared a short five-page summary that shows a side-by-side of the three proposed loans, as well as subsequent pages that highlight some of the key elements. And so, if I may, I'll walk through that. There are three proposed revolving loan funds with this bill. One of them is the Commercial Charter Fisheries Revolving Loan Fund, a Mariculture Revolving Loan Fund, and an Alaska Microloan Revolving Loan Fund. On page 2 of the short summary that we prepared, you can see a side-by-side that shows the capitalization amounts with commercial charter fisheries at $9 million, mariculture at $2.5 million, microloan at $3 million. The loan limits, again, in the same order, loan limit for commercial charter fisheries would be $100,000, mariculture $100,000, microloan at $35,000 for a single individual, and $70,000 cap for two or more. The loan terms are defined, the interest rates, the floor and ceiling. And I'd like to point out, in developing these, We worked closely with the individuals, with industry leaders in each of these sectors, with communities very interested in pursuing these avenues of economic development. And we also spoke directly with our commercial finance institutions in the state, including the Alaska Bankers Association. So, again, we feel that these are three areas that are very promising. Several of them have statewide implications, and in particular, the mariculture and the charter commercial fisheries have important implications and potential for coastal and rural Alaska. If I can go to page 3, I'd like to highlight a few elements regarding the Commercial Charter Fisheries Revolving Loan. This proposed revolving loan fund was developed in response to significant changes at the federal level developed by NOAA that affect Alaskans' access to halibut charter permits. And you can see the map highlighting areas 3A and 2C, which is South Central and Southeast Alaska. The purpose of this would be to allow Alaskans to retain ownership of these permits. It's important to point out that this is a new regime, and that in order for people to be even eligible to apply, they had to demonstrate history by having participated in either 2004 or 2005, as well as recent participation in 2008. And there was a specified number of years. They had to have logbooks showing five bottom fish trips that were taken. So again, when you think about the personal circumstances, mechanical issues, market issues, personal issues, there are a number of Alaskans that weren't eligible to apply, and even those that did apply, when you look at the middle of the page, NOAA took a little over 1,000 applicants. Alaskans are the vast majority of the interim applications that have been allowed. So we also know that at this early point, 121 permits were issued to non-Alaska residents. So again, we saw the potential with this significant regime change, and in this first year,
We are beginning to monitor how many Alaskans are in that interim status, how many non-Alaskans own have received the permits, and again, our whole purpose with this element of the proposed bill is to encourage that Alaska ownership of something that I think is very important, not only for economic development, but to our cultural identity as a state and what commercial fishing and charter fishing means. Moving to the revolving loan fund on page 4, that's the mariculture revolving loan, we see significant enthusiasm for this one, and I know we've got several people who are going to testify today from the private sector. We see significant potential for Alaska again here with mariculture and with aquatic plants. One of the things that I had a chance, well, we had a lot of enthusiasm for this bill. I had a chance to really see that personally firsthand when I traveled on behalf of the state of Alaska to China and South Korea in November. The trip had three major components, seafood marketing, tourism marketing, and I was also traveling with Commissioner Lucan, and we were talking about our air cargo potential and our unique capabilities. Again, seafood ties into that, and so again, I just it just really boosted my enthusiasm for it. We as a state have been investing through entities like Oceans Alaska and Ketchikan. We've also been looking at our regulatory regime, and again, we think that boosting the mariculture potential on a multi-pronged effort has significant economic development potential. Finally, moving to the last element on page 5 of the PowerPoint presentation, the microloan revolving fund. We believe this is an important niche, and some of you may recall that two sessions ago, in the second session of the 26th legislature, this bill was introduced as a standalone bill. Again, the loan limits are smaller than the others. This would be up to $35,000 for an individual, up to $75,000 for two or more. And we also have built in some additional flexibility with this. Unlike some of the other loans that exist, that are available, such as the Small Business Economic Development Program or Rural Development, RDIF, Rural Development Investment Fund, this would have statewide applicability. Turndowns would be required from commercial banking institutions for anything over $35,000. And I didn't specifically mention that in the prior. Turndowns would be required from commercial banks for the other loans that I walked through. We see, even though we see signs of recovery from the significant economic decline that we had a couple of years ago, when you look at small businesses and being able to access funds for working capital, for inventory expansion, or for some startup business, we see significant potential for this to help statewide enhance small business development. So again, I'm happy to answer questions about this, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to it.
We have initial questions for Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How did you come about arriving at the split on your capitalization of each of these programs?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, at the loan limit amount, can I clarify, is that?
No, the capitalization first. The 9, the 2.5, and the 3.
Thank you for the clarification. Through the chair, I have to say that the enthusiasm in the House and the recognition for the demand on the commercial charter fisheries, that the capitalization was increased in House financed and supported as the bill passed 40-0. The part of what we did internally initially was estimate what we thought that the loan limits would be, the market demand, and also a reasonable level to demonstrate the need in history for that. And we were, and Kathy, if you can assist me, I know we were looking at an estimated 25 market demand in the first year of 25 initial loans for the mariculture, and I believe 10 each for the others. But I do have to point out that as this bill was discussed in the House, without knowing what the outcome was going to be in that first year for the commercial charter fisheries, there was a recognition that Alaskans could be standing without those permits, and the capitalization was increased in the House.
Could you put a dollar amount on that, please?
$9 million capitalization, $2.5 million for mariculture, and $3 million for microloan.
Well, I know that. It's written in your format, but what was the initial submission? What was the change?
I'm sorry, Chairman.
Your initial calculations from your department that you anticipated a need for?
The initial capitalization proposed was $5 million.
Mm. For all three?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, $5 million for charter fisheries, and as the bill was discussed with the House Finance, $2.5 million for mariculture and $3 million for microloan were our initial proposed limits.
Any other initial questions?
I guess go ahead. I have one, Mr. Chairman. You know, I support commercial fisheries or fisheries in general, but and I support this, but coming from the district, Senate district that I represent, which is probably the largest fishing district in the state, plus I don't represent the Yukon and Upper Kuskokwim, those are not included, but are those programs so healthy that there is no need to assist those commercial fisheries on the other side? They might be able to apply for the microloans, but are they so healthy that they don't need any type of loans? And Univer saw fit to try to assist that part of the fisheries in this state?
Right.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the commercial fishing side of our financing section. The vast majority of the loans that we process are for commercial fishing, and I recognize that the statewide utilization in our coastal areas. One of the things that there's significant more flexibility for vessel, for permit, for fuel efficiency, engines, and other things on the commercial side. I also want to point out, especially with Kathy here, the utilization of our loan portfolio in total, again, which the vast majority of is commercial fishing, grew from FY10 to FY13 from 268 loans to 313, and about $20 million in utilization to $30 million. So again, we are still seeing significant use of the loans that we have. We also see businesses grow, once they develop some commercial financing history with us, grow on to commercial lenders. So I hope that gives you confidence that the commercial fishing industry is still a significant portion of the clientele that we serve.
Senator Hoffman, a follow-up?
Follow-up, I guess, you know, and many of the people out there are looking at becoming catcher, processors, sellers, marketing their own product. And, you know, they keep on saying that there's not enough emphasis placed upon that aspect of the fishery, so that they're bypassing a middleman. And I wonder if you might address the need for that type of assistance.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I know in our prior discussions we've talked about the strength of ASME and its value to the state and our fisheries in general. I think that two core areas for economic development activities include our financing and our marketing. And with your comments, I'm happy to discuss with our team where we can do more on those individual regional marketing entities, and where we can provide more, it may be more market research, or it may be more marketing tools. So again, we recognize that commercial fishing is not only a significant employer, it's significant in our role in coastal parts of our state.
Senator Hoffman?
I think you missed the question. You know, I understand that as me as well as anyone else. I'm saying that individual people want to be able to catch their fish, process it, and send them to market, but they need to be able to get a system where they can process the product and identify, and that doesn't exist today. So I wonder if there's assistance in a revolving loan program that could exist.
Right.
And that would affect Southeast as the whole state.
Right.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for the clarification. I could see the potential based on the business proposal for a business, particularly with to come to us under the microloan concept or under RDIF, the Rural Development Investment Fund, or SBED, which is a federal program, has a little bit different match requirements and different rules. But again, we have the ability to look through a couple of these different programs at a business concept. And I, in thinking about your points, I think we can do increase our outreach in making sure people realize these tools are here.
Okay. We've got a series of questions of interest on one side of the table. We're going to start with Senator Thomas and then Senator McGuire and Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your explanation of the bill. I do have the same concern about the rivers and the ability to them to access the revolving loan programs. We had a instance related to us, I think, last year, maybe the year before, of a Yukon River village that had a processing plant set up there and had a huge impact on the relatively small village and its economics, because prior to that, there was really nothing going on there. So I want to make sure that the folks are at least able to access these loans in some fashion, even if it might be only the third program, the microloans. And also wanted to ask about the how you determined the interest rates and whether or not you would be publishing an annual report on the successes of the program and maybe issues or problems that needed to be looked at in the future.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator. I do want to affirm that the microloan would definitely be available on a statewide basis. The RDIF program is specific for community populations that are 5,000 or less, that are not that are connected by road or rail to Anchorage or Fairbanks, or populations of 2,000 or less if they are connected. So we do have a specific specific revolving loan program that targets these rural communities, and part of the I'm pleased to report that there's been growth in loan utilization in that fund in this last year as well, but it's been small. And then back to publication of data, Kathy Jeans was just describing the reporting that we do, and if I can turn to Kathy.
For the record, my name is Kathy Jeans, Division Operations Manager for the Division of Economic Development. To the chair and to the senator, we do have mandated reports that we have to file by the end of January every year for commercial fishing and fisheries enhancement. And we could certainly also, if that was agreed to, that we could also do that for the microloan and the mariculture and the halibut charter program, if that was warranted.
You have a follow-up? Senator?
No, I just think that would be helpful to know how successful those programs are received in the throughout the state.
Okay, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chairs, and thank you both for the bill. I think it's innovative, and just a broader look. I'd like to see some of the data. You're holding the bill, I think, and mm-hmm. It's coming back up again, that goes into determining the principal amount. And so when I hear things like the House Finance Committee liked the commercial charter fisheries element so much that they upped it from $5 million to $9 million, I get a little concerned because it starts sounding like an auction. Why nine there versus not upping the mariculture and the microloans element? So I'd like to see a little bit more data as to what the right amount is for that principal to sustain this revolving loan program to make it successful. And then to that end, I think we're anticipating, the hope would be that we'll derive revenue from these loans. And this has long been a held belief of mine that we can diversify our economy this way with so much money in the bank and good credit standing in this area and others by lending. It's set up, all three are, as revolving loan funds, so that the profit would go back into the fund to help operate and account for losses. But is there a point at which you anticipate a roll-off of some of those profits coming back to the state?
Through the chairman, thank you, Senator McGuire, for your questions. And I'm afraid I did a disservice to the House. I do know that some of the metrics when they proposed the increase and it was supported, again, at this time last year, we hadn't seen that first wave of how many permits are going to be issued. We had some estimates. And so there was anticipation that prices could be as high as $100,000, and there was also an anticipation, knowing the interest in the proposed cap, that there could be as many as 100 Alaskans that were going to be needing to purchase a permit. You may own you may own your vessel, you may have an existing business, but if you weren't able to acquire the permit, there would be that need. So again, there was some basis behind that, and we have now a partial year of seeing that first wave of decisions and a partial year of seeing some prices. So Thank you for giving me an opportunity to provide a little more light on that, aside from the enthusiasm. And we can also follow up to provide a little more to the committee on each of those. We did anticipate that the prices would be as much as $100,000 for the commercial charter fisheries. We also recognize that the microloan limits were smaller. And then there's another point that I'd like to mention. It's in the bill, didn't put it in the overview, is that there's an ability with the commercial charter fisheries to have up to come back and have up to $200,000 under this particular. Someone might ask for a loan for the permit, and then in the subsequent year also be looking at a vessel, and under mariculture there's the ability, and it's clearly described in the bill, to come back in subsequent years and have a cap of $300,000. So again, part of these were developed by talking with industry members about what existing market prices are, what the development line is, and then also by doing scenarios with our financing staff on ensuring that the loans would revolve. And I'm very proud of the Division of Economic Development's work. Our loans do revolve, and they're reinvested back in new business development in the state.
Senator Thomas. Excuse me, Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Senator Thomas's questions, can you explain to me why the interest rates are different on the three different areas, and also why the floor and ceiling is so different?
And then if you could add on to his question and talk about the difference between the department and the commissioner and who authorizes these loans, why there's a difference there. Mariculture loans require collateral acceptable to the department, while the other loans are collateral accepted to the commissioner. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator Egan, we did work with the commercial finance industry as well as the in trying to give ourselves understanding our appropriate role as the state of Alaska when we're looking at the access to capital and what that continuum was. What I can say at this point is that we discussed with the financing, with the potential borrowers as well as with the finance community, what would be an appropriate niche. And these are also similar to the ranges that we have for our other loans as well. But I can come back with some additional detail as I talk with our staff. And then Senator Stedman, you had asked about the difference between the commissioner and the department, and I'd like to follow up on that. That may have been part of our drafting process, and I'd like to clarify.
Okay, and then also I'd like to have you get back to the committee on the default issues. One of the concerns here that it's noticeable in here that you could possibly be in default of other loans for the state and apply for these loans. There should be some cross-correlation for the borrowers. And also, if they're in default in other lending institutions dealing with the industry, if they have industry loans. So we've got a full picture of what's going on. One of the concerns I have is anytime you have easier access to capital, you have upward pressure on prices. So the easier we make the access to capital, the more expensive these permits are going to be. So there's got to be a balance in the process. Do we have any other initial questions in the? We have four updated fiscal notes in the packets. There are one fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development, with the general fund appropriations in the amount of $85,000 to cover the cost of administering the funds. Fiscal note of $9 million in general funds to capitalize the Charter Fisheries Loan Fund. One fiscal note for $3 million general funds to capitalize a mariculture loan. One fiscal note for $2,500,000 in general funds to capitalize a microloans. And we don't have anybody signed up in the off-net, but I have a couple of folks here in the audience that would like to come forward. So if we can make a little bit of room for them, and then we'll start with Roger Painter, please. You can come forward, introduce yourself for the record, who he represents, and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Roger Painter, and I'm president of the Alaskan Shellfish Growers Association. And I'd like to speak in favor of House Bill 121. We've been working with the department on this concept for a couple of years and are delighted they came up with this bill. I'd like to just briefly point out a couple of things. One is that there's tremendous demand for this type of financing. The U.S. Department of Agriculture currently has a farm service agency that makes loans to aquatic farmers, but these loans are strictly for operating capital and can't be used for front-end financing of new farms. Currently, there's probably enough applicants in the pipeline to utilize the entire $2.5 million capitalization. There are operations that are underway currently in communities like Yakutat, Angoon, Huna, Kasan, Cake, Nocody, Ketchikan, all areas that have very weak economies and can really use the stimulus of these new small businesses. I'd also like to point out that the reason the commercial banks are not interested in financing aquatic farms is that we really don't fit their business plan models. When I initially got into the business some 20-some years ago, I went to my bank, tried to get a loan. My partners and I had very good credit. We had good collateral. National Bank of Alaska at the time was very interested, but they were interested in giving us a loan that we had to repay in 3 years. We'd have to start making payments immediately. And a shellfish operation, it'll take 5 to 10 years to get revenues flowing through it. There was no way that we could get that loan and make it work. The situation hasn't changed at all over the past two decades. Again, I think this is a real important economic development tool, particularly in the coastal areas, which are struggling mightily, and one thing that the legislature ought to look at the capitalization of these loans is that they're really an investment in our economy, and they also are essentially putting money aside that's going to be there in future years. If we have some real rainy days, the legislature can come back and recapture that capitalization as these loans are repaid. And so it's a good long-term investment, particularly in our economy. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Painter, for that testimony. Do any committee members have questions? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Roger, for all your advocacy in this area. It's exciting to see this proposal before us today. For the capitalization amount of $2.5 million, you indicated that there would already be in the hopper enough support out there, enough people applying for that amount of principal. And so I guess my question, as I asked the commissioner earlier, would be we're in trying to ascertain what the right amount is to capitalize that fund. You can see that in the House Finance Committee, they raised that threshold for commercial charter fisheries. Would you advocate that this committee raise up the 2.5 principle in mariculture as well?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I'm starting this spring on a training program that's going to have five apprentice farmers in Cake and five in Nocatee. In 2 years, these people are going to be out there on the street looking for financing. Right now, there are enough people where by the time the department promulgates regulations and gets the money on the street to use up the entire fund, and I think capitalization of $5 million would provide some incentive for future growth in the industry.
Thank you.
Further questions of Mr. Painter? Thank you for your testimony. The next person up is Russell Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here today and speak in favor of HB 121. For the record, my name is Russell Dick. I'm the president and CEO of Ha'ani, which is a new subsidiary created by Sea Alaska in 2010 to really look at stimulating economic development and expansion within the Southeast Alaska region, and more particularly within the rural communities in our region. Two real fundamental objectives of Ha'ani, again, economic expansion, and not just the region. We're going to look at the region, but again, getting back into our rural communities. We all understand the challenges that we face in our rural communities today, but also removing impediments that residents in these rural communities have when they look at economic development and, you know, energy. Of course, we all know energy, but another one is access to affordable capital. And not just affordable capital, but capital with very flexible terms given the types of industries and some agriculture that we're going to be looking at and some of the issues that Roger talked about in terms of payback. As we went around to some of the communities, shellfish mariculture was something on the top of everybody's list. We saw it as something that fit within the entire region and the state to expand the economy, but also it was something that really fit the lifestyle of the folks that live in our rural communities, and I think that's very important to us. But two issues that we found, again, no real training opportunities. People didn't want to pick up their families and have to move someplace to get trained in mariculture. They wanted to stay at home. And again, no access to affordable capital. Banks are not going to lend against oyster farms. So we actually took the initiative and went out and we partnered with Pearl of Alaska down in Cake, put in a flup seed, an oyster nursery, and created an apprenticeship program with Tom Henderson and trained two oyster farmers down in Cake. We went ahead, we moved the project forward and established three oyster farms in the community of Yakutat in partnership with the Yakutat Kwan and the residents in Yakutat. Just capitalized a farm in Angoon with a shareholder, and got a lease site in Huna, and we're now talking with a couple of organizations on Prince of Wales Island to expand that program even further. And I think the point of that is that there is significant demand out there, and we're willing to put some private capital into doing this, but we think it's also important for the state to come forward and have a program available for entrepreneurs who want to engage in this type of business and this type of activity. And that's why we're supporting HB 121. We're going to continue to move this forward. We have no issue investing in these things as long as they have some economic impact in our rural communities. But we'd like to see a program available for these entrepreneurs as well. And part of this for us is ensuring that these oyster farms, I don't want to own oyster farms in my business. You know, it's more important for me to get those out into the communities, into the hands of the entrepreneurs, let them own their own businesses, because I think that's much more sustainable as we go forward. So I recognize the time commitment that you all have, and so I want to be brief with my comments and more than happy to submit more lengthy testimony in the future as well.
Thank you. And we may have an amendment to bar sea otters from eating oysters.
Working on that, too, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, because that is a problem we're dealing with down here.
Yes, it is.
Okay, next up. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Next up and last up, Paul Foose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Foose representing PAC Alaska and Alaska Sea Farms. And I hope to be able to tell you why this bill is necessary today. The people that started these gooey duck farms, they mortgaged their house, they drained their bank accounts, they did everything to go in and get these sites, capture some brood stock, send it to the hatchery in Seward, and then bring it back down and plant them. We didn't know what the growth rates were. We didn't know if it was going to work. So just this last year, we sent a sample of gooey ducks to Fish and Game to have them aged, and they did confirm that it takes about 7 to 8 years to grow a full-size gooey duck. Now, the market for this is really strong. This year, fishermen were paid $21 a pound for gooey ducks. That's the highest price paid for any fishery in the entire state of Alaska. So the market is strong. What's missing is the capital. We did go to the private banks, and they said, we loan you money on this to get going. You don't have any revenue for 7 to 8 years. You can't pay us back. But this is just the biology of the animal, and that's what we're up against. So the other thing is that just having said in Commissioner Bell's position previously, it's rare that you find an opportunity in rural Alaska economic development that's really based on the private sector where it can really grow. And I think in South Central Alaska, this is particularly important where a lot of other economic opportunities have gone by the wayside. I did want to point out also that because of the problems of financing, we haven't been able to make the commitment to buy seed from the hatchery. That's affected the economics of the hatchery in Seward. And I know they've come back to you a couple times. You may say see them against this year. We see this as a way, is also a way to get the hatchery on sound financial footing so that it can be self-sustaining. And I did also want to point out in terms of return to the state that anything that is harvested from these sites does pay the raw fish tax, 3% of the value, back to the state of Alaska. And you know, we would repay these loans, and you know, they'd be on a revolving basis. But right now, you know, this could be a $20 to $30 million industry here if we had the financing for it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Foose. That concludes our public testimony today for this bill. And we're going to go ahead and bring the commissioner back up. Commissioner Bell, does any of the committee members have any final questions for the commissioner? Seeing none, does the commissioner have any final comments before we set this bill aside?
Again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the bill. We'll follow up in the next day on the questions that were raised, and particularly noting the sensitivity to the default rate, which I hadn't mentioned specifically before. Again, the Division of Economic Development at this overall has just over 1% default rate. But as we go through the detailed questions, I'll be sure to add that.
Okay. In. When you define the default rate, sometimes it can be parsed in numerous ways. One way is if somebody has an agreement to catch up, they don't count it in default. So we could do your classical calculation for your default, but the committee would like to know how many loans have been in restructured, how many loans are behind and maybe haven't been classified as in default, so we get a clear, you know, expectation of what we're dealing with. And then we have a question from Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the Chair, Commissioner Bell, just since you are going to come back with more data, if in conversations with the Commissioner of DEC, Larry Hartig, if you could find out, I have that budget, and we upped the amount last year for PCP testing, and it's we're still not doing enough in this area, so I anticipate with this loan program there'll be more shellfish being tested, and if we could get an overall picture of what that increase might be.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Okay. No further questions. Thank the commissioner for coming forward today, presenting the bill. We'll set this bill aside for further review. That concludes today's meeting. The scheduled meeting tomorrow has been canceled, so there will be no Finance Committee meeting tomorrow. Friday, the 27th, we'll start again at 9 a.m. On the agenda is Senate Bill 167 to separate oil and gas production taxes. There will be also on the schedule other bills previously heard, and we're working on that agenda. We are not ready for the scholarship bill. We're still working on that language. But there's some other bills that will be coming out. So if you have any concerns on the previous bills that we have heard, make sure that that information is delivered to the office so we can take a look at that stuff. And if you have any feedback when we schedule the bills for Friday, don't hesitate, committee members, to let us know. So with that, we are adjourned.